broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
From 0100 GMT this evening and until the declaration of the state of emergency is concluded, only Spanish citizens, residents in Spain, cross-border workers, and those who prove force majeure or situation of extreme poverty will be allowed to enter national territory by land.
Europe is the epicenter of the coronavirus. Spain has now the second most cases in Europe, following Italy. Spain had more than 2,000 new cases in the last 24 hours, and the number of deaths has doubled. We'll go to Madrid for an update. Then San Francisco takes the most severe measures in the United States in response to COVID-19, telling its 7 million residents to shelter in place. Will go inside the Bay Area's San Quentin State Prison, where two prison blocks are under partial quarantine. We'll speak with incarcerated journalist Juan Moreno Huaynes.
We're well aware of what's happening outside the walls of San Quentin. So now when we hear this coronavirus and how deadly that's been worldwide, there's a natural anxiety that exists over here about what's going to happen to us when the public brings this illness to us.
With 2.3 million people locked in U.S. prisons and jails, the U.S. has the largest proportional prison population in the world. Then to Seattle to meet a 17-year-old boy behind a website tracking coronavirus cases that's now a vital global resource.
You know, when Ebola came out, or, you know, SARS or something like that, there wasn't just like a website you could go to easily on a phone and just see these stats updated every minute. So I think it's really interesting how I can help combat misinformation and just provide the straight facts.
Unlike President Trump, 17-year-old Avi Shiffman has been tracking coronavirus cases daily since December. His website has now reached far more than 40 million views around the world and growing. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. There are now over 183,000 confirmed cases of coronavirus worldwide, with over 7,100 reported deaths. The European Union's preparing to vote on a proposal to shut all external borders and impose a 30-day continent-wide foreign travel ban. In France, President Emmanuel Macron warned that French people are not heeding government directives and continue to gather in public space.
These efforts that I am asking of you, I know that they are novel, but the circumstances obliges us to do so. We are at war, and a health war surely. We're fighting neither another army nor our own nation, but the enemy is here, invisible, untouchable, which is advancing, and this requires our general mobilization.
France is planning to deploy 100,000 police to enforce the coronavirus lockdown and impose penalties for those who don't respect the new laws. The ongoing anti-government yellow vest protests have continued in the face of the new restrictions. Thousands of French security forces confronted hundreds of demonstrators Saturday in Paris. Macron did allow municipal elections to go ahead Sunday, despite concerns over crowds. Meanwhile, the pandemic continues to grip Spain, now the fourth most infected country worldwide, with over 9,000 cases and 300 deaths. 2,000 new cases were confirmed over the past day. The Spanish government announced it's nationalizing hospitals and private health care companies to better manage the pandemic. We'll go to Madrid for the latest after headlines. In Italy, reports emerged that overrun hospitals may have to start refusing intensive care treatment to patients over 80 years of age. This according to a draft of plans on how to cope with the crisis. Fiat Chrysler, PSA Group, and Renault announced they're closing 35 manufacturing facilities across Europe. Videos circulated on social media of Mercedes-Benz workers in Spain striking after they were asked to keep working during the pandemic. Canada has announced it's shutting its borders to foreign nationals, though the order has some exceptions, including for now U.S. citizens. Cuba's given permission for cruise ships to dock on the island if they're carrying COVID-19 patients, saying this is a time for solidarity and that health is a human right. A British cruise ship carrying five people who tested positive for coronavirus is set to dock in Cuba after days stranded in the ocean being turned away by other countries. Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte has put the entire island of Luzon, which includes the capital Manila, on lockdown, affecting 57 million people. There are 142 confirmed cases and 12 deaths in the Philippines. Critics say the quarantine presents a near impossible dilemma for the island's many hourly workers, who must choose between survival and their health. This is a Manila resident.
It's hard for the workers because they will get hungry. Their children will get hungry. What about the people who can't work because they are quarantined at home? They can't go out. They have no money for food.
South Africa has declared a national disaster, imposing massive travel bans. Sudan has sealed off all seaports, land crossings and airports, while Egypt, which has the highest number of coronavirus cases in Africa with at least 160 infections, announced it'll suspend all flights starting Thursday. 27 African countries have confirmed nearly 350 coronavirus cases. As COVID cases mount in the Middle East, there's growing concern Syria might face a major outbreak that could be catastrophic to civilians already dealing with the ongoing war and massive displacement. According to Iranian officials, the country has temporarily released 85,000 prisoners, including political prisoners, in response to the pandemic. The death toll in Iran has topped 850. Nearly 15,000 people have been infected. In Latin America, Chile is closing its borders Wednesday and imposing isolation as the nation has the highest number of coronavirus cases in South America. Venezuela and Peru have also ordered all citizens to stay home. Colombia and Costa Rica are also closing their borders and imposing curfews. Meanwhile, China marked a major milestone Tuesday as it announced it had just one new case over the past day. Here in the United States, there have been more than 4,500 confirmed cases and 87 deaths, but more accurate numbers are still not known as testing remains extremely limited. The numbers of those infected are expected to be thousands more if they had access to those tests. President Trump released national guidelines Monday designed to help control the spread of COVID-19, including avoiding gatherings of more than 10 people, stopping discretionary travel, avoiding restaurants, bars, gyms, and other public places for the next 2 weeks. Trump appeared to acknowledge the severity of the pandemic for the first time, saying, quote, "This is a bad one. It's just so contagious." Trump responded to a reporter asking him to rate his administration's response to the pandemic.
I'd rate it a 10. I think we've done a great job. And it started with the fact that we kept a very highly infected country, despite all of the, even the professionals saying, no, it's too early to do that. We were very, very early with respect to China. And we would have a whole different situation in this country if we didn't do that. I would rate it a very, very, I would rate ourselves and the professionals. I think the professionals have done a fantastic job.
The reporter asked him to rate the U.S. response on a scale of 1 to 10. President Trump said 10. Medical and public health experts say Trump's early dismissal and delayed response to the outbreak contributed to coronavirus spreading undetected for weeks. Trump again attacked New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, tweeting, "Just had a very good teleconference with nation's governors. Went very well. Cuomo of New York has to do more," unquote. New York recently closed all its schools, restaurants, entertainment venues in an effort to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Residents across six counties in the San Francisco Bay Area have been ordered to shelter in place until April 7th. Directive affects around 7 million people. As of Monday, 37 states and the District of Columbia have moved to close public schools in some way. Over 37 million students and their families are being affected. Many districts are implementing alternative plans so that students who need it can still receive free meals. The U.S. Supreme Court is delaying oral arguments. It's the first time the court's taken such measures since the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic. The court was scheduled to hear arguments later this month around Trump's attempts to shield his tax returns and financial documents from lawmakers and a New York prosecutor. The U.S. airline industry is seeking a $50 billion bailout package to cope with the fallout of the outbreak. Trump tweeted Monday, quote, "The United States will be powerfully supporting those industries like airlines and others that are particularly affected by the Chinese virus. We will be stronger than ever before," he said. The Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization have explicitly warned that referring to COVID-19 as a Chinese virus is not accurate and further fuels racism against Chinese people and other people of Asian descent. Trump did not offer similar assistance to homeless people, the uninsured, the unemployed, and workers who will be affected by the pandemic. In election news, Kentucky became the latest state to postpone its primary over the outbreak. Meanwhile, in Ohio, which was set to vote today, the fate of the primary was uncertain until now after Governor Mike DeWine ordered officials to not open polling places despite a judge denying a last-minute bid to delay the election. In the end, though, the election primaries have been postponed in Ohio. Election officials in Arizona, Florida, and Illinois said their primaries will proceed as scheduled today. In Ohio, the ACLU welcomed the release of vulnerable prisoners in Cuyahoga County during the pandemic. The prisoners either had their cases settled or released on house arrest. The ACLU and other rights groups are calling on prisons around the United States to release high-risk and elderly prisoners. Meanwhile, in New York, an investigator with the Department of Correction died after contracting COVID-19. The investigator had limited contact with prisoners, according to officials, but his death further fueled concerns over how to protect prisons during the outbreak. The New York City Department of Correction said Monday it was suspending in-person visits starting this week. In New York City and other locations around the country, St. Patrick's Day celebrations have been canceled or postponed. It's the first time the event has been called off in New York City in over 250 years. Other major annual events include the Kentucky Derby. It's been called off. Major League Baseball became the latest sporting organization to suspend its season. Amazon said Monday it's hiring an additional 100,000 warehouse and delivery workers to handle a surge in online shopping. A government official said Monday the first clinical trial of a coronavirus vaccine had begun. It could take from 1 year to 18 months to fully validate any potential vaccine. The White House said more coronavirus drive-through and walk-through test locations will open this week. This comes as German biotech firm CureVac has denied reports Trump attempted to get exclusive rights to a coronavirus vaccine it's developing. Reports emerged over the weekend Trump offered the CureVac CEO around $1 billion for the rights, which would make the vaccine available only in the United States. CureVac's majority owner, co-founder of German software giant SAP, reportedly confirmed the conversation took place despite the recent denial. German officials also confirmed the story and rejected the idea, saying, quote, "If a vaccine is developed in Germany, then it is for Germany and the world," they said. The White House has also denied the reports. The Dow dropped nearly 3,000 points, and the S&P 500 fell about 12% Monday, the largest drop since 1987's Black Monday, despite the Fed cutting interest rates to near zero. Over the weekend, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said the stock market turmoil is a, quote, "great investment opportunity for long-term investment." A reporter asked Trump Monday if the economy was headed toward a recession.
Well, it may be. We're not thinking in terms of recession. We're thinking in terms of the virus. Once we stop, I think there's a tremendous pent-up demand, both in terms of the stock market and in terms of the economy.
And once this goes away, once it goes through and we're done with it, I think you're going to see a tremendous surge.
In Greece, a child was killed by a fire at an overcrowded migrant camp on the island of Lesbos Monday. The girl was believed to be 6 or 7 years old. The cause of the fire has not been confirmed. The Moria camp, which has a capacity of less than 3,000 people, is now housing over 19,000 refugees. Doctors Without Borders urged Greece Sunday to immediately evacuate refugees living in overcrowded camps because of fears the coronavirus would quickly spiral out of control if it reaches the camps. In Israel, President Reuven Rivlin has asked former army chief and head of the Blue and White Party, Benny Gantz, to form a new government in the latest blow to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu's Likud party received more votes than Gantz in this month's election, but Gantz received endorsements from enough lawmakers to narrowly hold majority support. The United States is pulling out of several key bases in Iraq and heightened tensions in the region. Two Americans and one Briton were killed and over a dozen others injured in a rocket attack at the Taji military base near Baghdad last week. The U.S. responded by launching retaliatory airstrikes against Iranian-backed militia sites, and on Saturday, rockets struck a base housing U.S. troops. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo warned Monday the U.S. would take self-defensive action if attacked. New York Times is reporting Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other Republican senators have been privately contacting conservative federal judges to urge them to retire so they can be replaced by Republicans still while the Republicans control the Senate and Trump is in the White House. Over 90 Republican-nominated judges would be eligible for senior status, which opens up their spots on the bench while allowing them to keep hearing cases and receive full pay. Trump has appointed over 180 federal judges since coming into office, including around 50 appeals court judges, which amounts to nearly one quarter of all federal appeals court judges. In Missouri, a gunman opened fire at a gas station convenience store, killing five people, including himself. A police officer was also among the dead. The identity and motive of the shooter has not yet been revealed. And in Maryland, the Senate voted unanimously to pass a bill providing $580 million to the state's four historically black colleges and universities over 10 years. The legislation was already approved in the Maryland House. It is part of a settlement in a lawsuit that alleges Maryland consistently discriminated against and underfunded HBCUs. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Spain, which is now the second European country to impose a nationwide lockdown after 2,000 new coronavirus cases were confirmed in the last 24 hours and the number of deaths doubled. Spain now has the second most cases in Europe after Italy, the fourth highest number worldwide, with more than 11,000 infections and nearly 500 deaths. Spain's interior minister, Fernando Grande Marlaska, announced the country was shutting down to slow the spread of coronavirus.
From 0100 GMT this evening and until the declaration of the state of emergency is concluded, only Spanish citizens, residents in Spain, cross-border workers, and those who prove force majeure or situation of extreme poverty will be allowed to enter national territory by land.
As the European Union prepares to vote on a proposal to shut all external borders and impose a 30-day continent-wide foreign travel ban, Portugal's already suspended all passenger air and rail traffic with neighboring Spain until April 15th. At the border checkpoint, Spain is now allowing only Spaniards, residents of Spain, cross-border workers, and diplomats to enter the country.
They are only asking for identification, the national card, nothing else. They should test us for fever because at the end it's a checkpoint, but just for identification.
This comes as the Spanish government announced it's nationalizing hospitals and private health care companies to better manage the pandemic. Over the weekend, the Spanish people came outside to cheer medical workers in the streets as the country prepared to shut down. And the Spanish government has just announced a moratorium on mortgage payments and guarantee that basic services, that's water, gas, electricity, will not be shut off for non-payment during the crisis. For more, we go to Madrid, Spain, where we're joined by Maria Carrion, freelance journalist, former Democracy Now! Producer, also executive director of FISAHARA and co-founder of Nomads HRC, which focuses on human rights in Western Sahara. Maria, it's great to have you with us. I talked to you just after the shutdown of your country. Why don't you just take us through it? We only have a few minutes. But what happened this weekend after you had last weekend, International Women's Day, tens of thousands of women marching in the streets? And then this past Sunday, tell us what the government did.
The government to see for natural disasters, it goes beyond. It gives the government, the central government, extraordinary powers. It has taken control of basically police, health facilities, and both public and private initiatives. It has taken control of all of that in order to manage the crisis. So, as you said in the lead, that includes a temporary nationalization of the private healthcare sector. We are now confined to our homes. There's just a few exceptions, and it's what's happening basically in every country that's shutting down. So we're allowed to go get basic things like food, to go take care of dependents, to go to we can go to our jobs if our jobs cannot be contained inside homes and we cannot work remotely. You can obviously go to the drugstore, the pharmacy, and you can also go to the doctor if it's very important. People have actually cleared the streets. Spain is now a ghost country, in a sense. You hardly see anyone on the street unless they're going to their jobs. The weekend was especially illustrative of this because most people were home anyway. On Monday, yesterday, you saw a few more people out in the streets and on the trains commuting to work. But the streets have definitely cleared out. Four ministries are now in charge of managing the crisis. The health ministry, which is basically appropriating private facilities as well to manage and resources to manage the crisis. The Interior Ministry, which is kind of like Homeland Security in the FBI in the United States, now controlling all police forces, including autonomous regional police forces in the Basque Country and in Catalonia. The Defense Ministry, which has put basically the military installations and personnel at the disposal of the central government for this, and the Transportation Ministry, which handles public transportation and decides how much of it shuts down, and also highways and roads that obviously have to be managed as well, because most of us cannot go anywhere.
So Maria, talk
what
about...
does this mean? It means that
talk about the leadership of the country. I mean, the partners of the prime minister has tested positive of the that's Prime Minister Sanchez, of the Deputy Prime Minister. Go through it. The partners of both have tested positive, both women.
Basically Pedro Sanchez's wife has tested positive, and so he's in quarantine. Pablo Iglesias is one of the three vice presidents of the country, and he belongs to the Podemos, Unidas Podemos party. It's a coalition government, so it's socialists and Unidas Podemos, which is the party that was born out of the Indignados movement after the financial crisis. Pablo Iglesias' partner, who's also a minister of equality, has tested positive, and also people in two regional leaders, King Torra of Catalonia and the president of Madrid, Isabel Ayuso, have tested positive and are in quarantine as well. A lot of these women actually were at the feminist march of almost 2 weeks ago in March 8th. We don't know, if that was related. So, yes, there are a lot of people in leadership who are in quarantine. And, in fact, there's right now an ongoing cabinet meeting, an urgent cabinet meeting to determine the economic, the fiscal measures that will be taken, the way that financially they're going to be supporting families and businesses and so on, and it's taking place remotely to protect all of the cabinet ministers from getting infected.
And the head of the Conservative Party, the Vox Party, Maria?
Yes, both the head and his deputy were at this huge party gathering. This is Vox, the extreme right-wing party that won about 50 seats in parliament in Spain in the last elections. And they're very anti-immigrant and have they're on record saying we have to keep immigrants out because they bring epidemics into the country. Now they're both infected. This is Santiago Abascal and Javier.
And isn't it true that one of them was at CPAC in the United States? The conservative political
action. Santiago Abascal was in Washington.
Oh, was in Washington.
Yes. Yes. And then he came back and was tested positive. So yes, a lot of people in leadership and even in these parties who claim that it's immigrants bringing in viruses are now having to self-quarantine. And really today, the most important thing that's happening, because the first round of measures, this decree happened over the weekend, but today is where everybody is waiting to hear exactly what the government is going to do to help people whose lives have shut down, who've been temporarily laid off or fired from their jobs, who don't know how they're going to be paying their mortgages, they don't know how they're going to be paying their rental, their rent. Basically, what you just announced, the moratorium on mortgages just is like 5 minutes ago was announced, but there's a whole round of measures that they need to agree upon. This is a coalition government, and it's their first enormous test of unity, because Podemos, of course, is to the left, and they are really pressing for a more generous package for working people. Especially, we're all remembering the 2008 financial crisis and how banks were bailed out, but people were not, and we were just recovering from that. In terms of, especially the most vulnerable people.
Maria Carrion, we're going to have to leave it there. And most importantly, to talk about the most vulnerable in Spain and throughout the world, which will bring us to our next segment, where we're going to go into the San Quentin prison. The U.S. has the largest prison population proportionately in the world. Maria Carrion, former Democracy Now! Producer, now living in Madrid, Spain, where she is a freelance journalist and head of FISAHARA. I'm Amy Goodman. We'll be back in a sec. Spaniards from their balconies and homes while on lockdown. This is Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. As confirmed coronavirus cases in the U.S. pass 4,500, and I have to emphasize the devastating lack of tests in this country mean that number is probably exponentially higher. But at this point, what we know is there are at least 87 deaths. Residents across six counties in San Francisco Bay Area are under some of the strictest measures in the United States. They've been ordered to shelter in place as of midnight last night until April 7th. The Bay Area order affects 7 million people. But what about the people in the area's jails and prisons? San Francisco's new district attorney, Chesa Boudin, and San Francisco public defender are calling on their staffs to keep as many people out of jail as possible. At 2.3 million people locked up in U.S. prisons and jails, the U.S. has the largest proportional prison population in the world. Well, on Friday, we reached Juan Moreno-Haynes on the phone at San Quentin State Prison in the Bay Area, just days before two prison blocks there were quarantined. At this time, no cases of COVID-19 had been reported in the prison. Juan Moreno-Haynes is a member of the Society of Professional Journalists. His recent article for The Appeal is, "In San Quentin Prison, Getting the Flu Can Land You in Solitary Confinement." So I began by asking Juan to describe the scene at San Quentin.
Right now, I'm in North Block. That's the main line of San Quentin State Prison, and I'm in a payphone. It actually looks like a payphone, phone number 6, where I'm watching people going past back and forth in the unit on a regular morning in North Block at San Quentin State Prison.
So, Juan, we're talking to you on March 13th. This is very relevant to give a marker for this moment, because we're in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how you're experiencing that at San Quentin, where you're imprisoned.
So here at San Quentin, we get most of our news from the television, some from the radio. And so we're well aware of what's happening outside the walls of San Quentin. So now when we hear this coronavirus and how deadly that's been worldwide, there's a natural anxiety that exists over here about what's going to happen to us when the public brings this illness to us, because the one thing that we know for sure is that it's going to be brought in from the outside. And the way prisons operate, particularly San Quentin, because of its just unique style, there's more than 3,000 volunteers that come in and out of this prison on an annual basis. And so what the prison has done to prepare itself for this right now is that some of the volunteers that come in for the really big programs have selectively decided not to come in so that they don't bring this illness to us. What the administration has done at this point, and I don't have any official documentation to show this, this is only what I've been told, is that our visitations over the weekends have been canceled. What the administration has also done is posted just dozens and dozens of signs around on proper hand washing techniques and information on how the illness is spread. But that doesn't lift the anxiety level that the men have. When I walk the yard, the guys that know me ask me, Juan, what's going to happen? And my personal opinion is that it's not a matter of if it's going to happen, it's when it's going to happen. So right now, we're in this state of unknowing, and we're just anticipating how this illness is going to affect our lives.
So, Juan, let me read you an article from CVS San Francisco. The San Francisco Public Defender's Office is calling for the immediate release of pretrial jail inmates who are at heightened risk of contracting the coronavirus. In a statement, Public Defender Manaraju said his office would begin filing motions to seek the release of all clients in San Francisco County jails at heightened risk, such as people over 60, those with heart or lung disease, diabetes, cancer, HIV, or autoimmune diseases. And I want to ask, now that is not San Quentin, of course, but what about especially the older population at San Quentin, people who are over 60, people who are over 80? What are you calling for now? Is there any discussion of early release because they are threatened in this pandemic?
Okay, so the situation in CDCR is that by court order, they're allowed to keep the population at 137.5% of design capacity. And so what that means is that San Quentin is over design capacity. I can't tell you the exact number specifically for San Quentin, but that. And then the other thing about the San Quentin population is if you look at the median age of the population at San Quentin, it's higher than the median age of CDCR. So what does that mean to me? That means that we're a particularly vulnerable population. But the mechanisms for release are complicated and cumbersome. And I just really can't, in an ideal world, how do you deal with that? I really can't call for any suggestions for CDCR other than to know that San Quentin is particularly vulnerable.
Hmm. I'm wondering if you can describe San Quentin on lockdown. Among the issues, for example, how much access do you have to clean water and soap, which is absolutely critical to stopping the spread of the coronavirus?
Okay, so the way supplies are passed out, cleaning supplies are passed out in North Block, is that once a week, the porters who clean the unit goes around and passes out 2 bars of soap per cell. In addition to that, there's disinfectant that you could bring, like, about a 6 to 8 ounce bottle, and the porters will pass out different various types of disinfectant. If we're on lockdown, what happens is that they'll still end up passing out the soap, but then they'll send the porters around with bleach and cleaning supplies, and they'll be wiping down every area where people's hands are touched. As far as, like, showers are concerned, while on lockdown or modified program, the prisoners are allowed to shower once every 3 days.
If you run out of soap, because simple hand soap and water are by far the most effective in breaking down, in fighting the coronavirus before you get it, do people have to pay for more soap for the commissary, or will they provide more? And then what happens to those who can't afford it?
Okay, good question. While we're on lockdown, we don't have the capability of going to the canteen to buy soap. So we're completely dependent on the unit to supply us with soap. If they run out of soap or they fall short of soap, typically we borrow from each other, and, it kind of works like that. So right now what people are doing is they're, like, making sure they go into the canteen and they're buying supplies, particularly cleaning supplies and food. The experienced prisoner knows to stock up when there's potential for a lockdown, because once you go on lockdown, you don't know how long that's going to last, and things like food and cleaning supplies are essential, because if you're relying on the state to give you these supplies, it's just not going to be adequate.
Mm. You know, Juan, you wrote a prophetic piece called In San Quentin Prison, Getting the Flu Can Land You in Solitary Confinement. When we broadcast this, San Quentin may be on lockdown, maybe not. We maybe won't be able to reach you. But can you talk about what happens when you get sick at San Quentin?
So we live in such close proximity that in the 13 years that I've been in San Quentin, if I see somebody with the flu or sick, I'm going to get it. I already know this. I'm going to get it. There's no avoiding it. What happens when multiple people, when it gets epidemic, pandemic, when it really starts to spread, what the administration would do would take the people who had those flu-like symptoms and place them in Carson Unit, which is administrative segregation.
And what is administrative segregation?
Most people know it as the hole.
Solitary confinement.
Yes. Now, the problem with that is that when these sick people are put in solitary confinement, they don't feel like they're getting medical treatment. They feel totally isolated. And I just, in my mind, if I were sick and then put in a situation where I just felt horrible just because of my living conditions, that's not something that I would want to do. And that's the prevailing feeling of the people that I've interviewed that have gotten sick and were checked to Carson Unit. Because the conditions there aren't equipped to handle medical patients.
In your piece for the appeal, you write about a 52-year-old man named Michael Adams. You quote him saying, it's scary to be a man of a certain age after your health is compromised and be in a place that doesn't seem to care if you're dying. Adams goes on, I was pretty upset about that. It highlighted the warehousing effect of prison and the poor protocols that are in place in the event of a real health crisis. Tell us the story of Michael D. Adams, Juan.
Michael was just, he's been at San Quentin for about as long as I have, and he got sick and ended up going to the what's called the TTA, is the triage section of the of our medical department here, and his temperature was up, and he ended up going to Carson. So I interviewed him about his whole experience the resulting, it was kind of like the backbone of the story of punished for being sick. And that's one of the things that he said. He felt like that he was going to a whole new prison just for being sick when they sent him over to Carson. It was, for him, it was very debilitating for him to be sick and then be subjected to that type of treatment.
Juan Moreno-Haynes, I want to read from your article that you wrote there in prison at San Quentin for the appeal. You write, according to the American Journal of Psychiatry, several U.S. and European studies on solitary confinement have found people can suffer lasting psychiatric injuries even after short periods of isolation. If you can talk further about that, and then you have this combination of both sickness and the psychiatric effects of solitary.
So some of the guys that that I interviewed that were subjected to that, they're still here at San Quentin. And I'm not saying that, I'm saying they remember that. Those are lasting memories. Like when I re-interviewed Dwayne Brooks, I interviewed him probably a couple years after he was he had been sent to Carson for having a temperature, and he remembered that, and that's when he told me, if they come by to take his temperature again, he's gonna do whatever he can to prevent his temperature from being shown high, put cold water in his mouth or whatever. It just seems kind of just strange for a person to be sick and not want to be treated for their illness because that treatment's going to involve something that they feel is worse.
I want to ask you about your award-winning journalism at San Quentin. You're a member of the Society of Professional Journalists. You write for The Appeal. I mean, this is a time that journalism is so important for many reasons. To let people on the outside know what's happening on the inside in this time of the coronavirus pandemic, but also to provide information for people on the inside, critical information about how they can protect themselves, and also what's happening inside, telling people stories as you do so well. If you can tell us about practicing journalism behind bars and what this means now in the compounded time of the pandemic.
I work with other guys here also and try to tell just the story as accurately as possible. because I don't have to tell you prison is a bad place to live. I don't have to tell you the treatment is inhumane. I don't have to tell you anything. What I tell the journalists behind bars is just let those who read what you write make their own judgment about what you are reporting. And that's really all we have to do in order to give the public and readers an accurate portrayal of what's happening here. At San Quentin.
Juan, very quickly, you're over 60. That is the risk group, the highest risk group. I guess people over 80 are, but 60 is there. For people who to get the coronavirus and to suffer from it, your thoughts? Are you worried?
Of course I'm worried. I keep my hands clean. The porter just walked by with a spray bottle bleached, and he's cleaning out the phone booth. I live here, and, when coronavirus comes inside of this prison, I just hope I can survive it.
That's Juan Moreno-Haynes, incarcerated journalist, one of the people we interviewed 2 years ago when the Democracy Now! Team visited San Quentin and the San Quentin News. This is Democracy Now! Back in 10 seconds. Staying Alive by the Bee Gees. During the break, we are showing video of some social media of healthcare workers in protective gear dancing. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. During Monday's coronavirus press conference, President Trump said, "We have a problem that a month ago nobody thought about." Well, one 17-year-old Seattle resident did. This is 17-year-old Avi Schiffman, who's been tracking coronavirus cases since December. His website, ncove2019.live. We spoke on Friday.
Yeah, I started this website around Christmas of last year. The main goal of it was to provide just an easy way to see the straight facts and the data, without having to make a website that was biased or, full of ads or anything like that. So, you can, go on a phone and just instantly see the quick facts. You can see the total amount of cases, the total deaths, and, all that kind of information. And you can get that for individual countries and now U.S. states, too, and all kinds of things. So I didn't want to make it hard. You shouldn't have to go through government websites and download, a daily PDF that's probably out of date by the time you read it. And, have to go through all kinds of complicated things just to see, the straight facts. So that was the main reason why
I
wanted to make this website.
How did you know what the Trump administration didn't know? We're talking about last December. No one was talking about this in the United States. Yes, this was a terrible crisis in China. What first sparked your interest to do this?
Yeah, so, when I started this website, there was less than, 1,000 total cases, and they were all just in, the Wuhan area of China. So I saw this on the news, a long time ago, and I noticed that it was really hard just to find the information, and there was a lot of just misinformation spreading. So I decided it would be kind of cool to create a website and just kind of make it, a central hub of information.
And how did you do it? How did you code this? How do you know how to do this?
Yeah, I've been programming for about a decade now, but I've only been doing web development for a couple months, so a lot of it was, just kind of learning as I went along. You can learn anything online. I just if I had a question, I didn't know how to do a certain thing, I just went on Google and searched it up, figured out how to do it, and eventually got it to work.
So talk about how this website works. We're using it every single day at Democracy Now! Because right before we go on the air, we want to give people the latest figures. How often are you updating this? How does this automatically update for each country in the world?
Sure. So the entire website updates every minute or so, and the way it works is with something called web scraping. So I'm able to input websites such as, let's say Korea. They have a local government health department kind of website that updates those information those numbers all the time, so I'm able to web scrape those tables and stuff and get the latest information. And then there's also plenty of news sources as well, so there's plenty of reputable news sources. In Korea, there's one called Yonhap, I believe, that's pretty reputable, and sometimes they're able to get the information faster than those local Korean government sites. So it goes around, you know, for all those kind of places. China, for example, every province has their own health department kind of website, and they have all kinds of information and all the numbers, and I basically just wrote a script that every minute or so just goes to those websites and downloads the latest information.
So talk about the way you've broken it down at the top. When you hit the website, we see it starts out with explain each of the set of numbers before you go into the countries, and then you break down the countries.
Yeah, so right now, as soon as you go to the website, especially on a mobile device, you just see the quick facts. You know, you see the totals of, you know, the deceased and infected and recovered, and then you're able to see individual tables that you can sort and search. So let's say I want to sort specifically Europe just by how many deceased there were, then I'm able to sort it that way, and I can see all that kind of information for individual countries, and I've been working to break it down. So, for example, the United States, you can see in the individual states. You can see the same thing for Australia, and later tonight I'll probably have something for other places too, like India, where you can see the individual kind of provinces, state, region, areas.
So you have the number of people affected overall in the globe, and then by country, and then by region. You have the number of people who have died, and you have the number of people who have recovered. Talk about how that came into being.
Yeah, so that was kind of interesting. So that wasn't there for quite a while. And I started to get a lot of emails saying that the site was kind of overly negative. And I decided that it would be really cool if I could show how many people were recovering to give people a more positive outlook and maybe more hope. So I added that to the quick facts. In every single country, you can see how many people have recovered, which I think gives people a lot of hope, because you can see in places like Korea, I think they reported more people that recovered today than people that had been infected, which is really big. And I'm also working on things like a vaccine tracker to continue making it more positive, because it shouldn't have to be, you know, super negative and you only see, you know, the amount of people that have died.
What does a vaccine tracker mean, Avi?
Yeah, so around the world, there's, you know, plenty of governments and private health kind of companies that are working on antiviral medications, and there are vaccine trials going on. So right now there is no cure, but, you know, plenty of people are working on some kind of preventative measures. So I thought it would be kind of interesting for people to kind of track that, I guess, you know, track their progress and how far they are into these clinical trials, you know, what stage they're in, and all that kind of cool stuff.
So talk about who is watching this. I mean, we're talking about, are you at 12 million now?
Right now I'm at about 35 million.
You're 35 million viewers, users of your website.
The past 24 hours, the past 24 hours has been about 6.5 million visitors, so it's a lot of pressure.
I mean, this is astounding. How many people outside the United States, inside, where are most of the people viewing your website from?
So what's really interesting is that only about 60% of my traffic is from the United States, which means that I'm able to see it breaking down per country. And actually, I get a lot of visitors from places like Taiwan and, you know, United Kingdom and France, and a lot of places in Europe and Asia visit my website, too. So that's why I'm also working on translations, because, you know, if you're in Taiwan, you might like to see the website in Chinese more than English. So I'm working on things like that, too.
And what have you been able to learn about the transmission of the disease of COVID-19 as a result of your tracking?
Yeah, so one thing that's been really interesting to see is that you can see countries like Iran and South Korea, they used to have, you know, pretty similar kind of case counts, but you'd see that Iran would have, you know, 5 times more deaths, which is just insane. So I think it's really interesting that you're able to see the kind of difference in fatality rates depending on the country's healthcare system and how they're dealing with it, you know, transparency-wise.
Who taught you to code?
I learned myself just watching YouTube videos and just reading online kind of articles and things. I mean, you can learn anything online. You can learn underwater basket weaving for all you want. I mean, there's just so much great resources out there, and I think that's what's really cool about the internet. I mean, I can just go on YouTube and I can find a 14-hour long tutorial on how to code websites. You know, there's anything out there.
So you are 17 years old. You're a high school junior. School is now out. You code hours a day anyway, even with school. What are your plans now that Mercer Island High School, like the Seattle school system or many of the schools within it, have ended?
Yeah, now that it's closed, I'm able to work on the website a lot more and stay up, you know, later without having to worry about going to school in the morning. So and then it's also pretty helpful, you know, just because they're like, for example, there's a student that's helping me with media things and going through my emails and stuff. So now that school's out, you know, more people are able to help me that I know personally. So, yeah, it's been really cool.
And finally, if you can talk about this is not just sort of an academic project. This is, you are documenting a life and death moment, not only in the United States, but all over the world. If you can talk about message you have for other youth, and also the conversations you're having with people off and online about how to protect the most vulnerable, and just what this has meant for you. Has it shifted your view of the world and what young people can do?
Yeah, so I think a really interesting thing about this is that we're at the point where we can use technology and, you know, all kinds of great online kind of things with big things like world events, for example, this global pandemic. You know, when Ebola came out, or, you know, SARS or something like that, there wasn't just like a website you could go to easily on a phone and just see these stats updated every minute. So I think it's really interesting how I can help combat misinformation and just provide the straight facts. And also that, you know, this is just so cool how you can combine technology and global health together to just make something really neat. And I hope it inspires a lot of people to, you know, maybe learn programming and make their own tracker in the future. Because, you know, the more information that's easily accessible, the better. You know, you shouldn't have to read Korean government websites to just know how many people are infected in Korea. So, yeah.
Well, I finally want to ask you about another 17-year-old, the Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, known for her Fridays for Future school strikes. She just called for digital strikes during the coronavirus outbreak instead of the mass public events that happen in many communities. She tweeted, "We can't solve a crisis without treating it as a crisis, and we must unite behind experts and science." This, of course, goes for all crises. Now the experts urge us to avoid big public gatherings for a better chance to flatten the curve and slow the spreading of the coronavirus. We, the young people, are the least affected by this virus, but it's essential that we act in solidarity with the most vulnerable and that we act in the best interest of our common society. Had you heard about Greta Thunberg, and what are your final thoughts,
Abby? Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's definitely a big thing that we're able to use all these resources, you know, as myself, you know, I'm just 17, but it's really cool that I'm able to provide, you know, there's a wiki page on the site that has all kinds of information, you know, what to do if you're infected or, you know, the symptoms and kind of things. And I think it's really cool that I'm able to put that information out there for the rest of the world and all kinds of adults, that way they can just, you know, easily access it.
Well, Avi Shiffman, I want to thank you for being with us. Avi is 17 years old, high school junior at Mercer Island High School, which has closed. It's right outside Seattle, Washington. He developed this most remarkable coronavirus tracker. And finally, Avi, when I was asking you how you pronounce the name of your website, you said you might be changing it. Tell us the website again and what you're thinking of changing it to, why you came up with that name.
Sure. So right now the website domain is ncov2019.live, which is pretty hard to, you know, even say or remember. So, I mean, that used to be the unofficial name of the virus, but now that it's changed, I'd like to rename the website. I bought a domain called germtracker.com. That way it's so much easier to remember, and that way I can also use it in the future for more global pandemics. I mean, because, you know, there's only going to be another big thing a couple of years from now. And, you know, I'll be the first one to make a tracker for it. So,
well, I want to thank you so much, Avi. Again, all the very, very best to you, to your family, to the community. And thank you for helping the entire community, not only in this country, but around the world. Avi Shiffman, 17-year-old high school junior, speaking to us from Seattle, Washington. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable group of people. I want to thank Julie Crosby and Miriam Barnard. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriano Contreras, Maria Tarasena. Special thanks to Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira. Happy birthday to Julia Thomas. And thank you so much to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Guys and dolls, you are at the malt shop with Daddy G and WGFR, and we're going back to the 50s and the 60s, okay? So hang those fuzzy tights on the rear view mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the malt shop, where the kids are dancing, and the jukebox playing, and here we are, back in the 50s.
You know you could have been a hand.